Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to move now to the next stage in our conference. We managed reasonably well. We're only 5 minutes late. I addressed a conference of school principals about 2 years ago, and they kept me waiting 45 minutes. And I thought it was rather ironic that people who plagued me all my life for being coming late to school should do that. And I said it, and they had the sense of humour of a headmaster and a headmistress. Now, we're listening to two presentations this morning, one on human rights, faith for a secular age, and then who is my neighbour at work? We've got two distinguished speakers. The first is Professor Conor Grierty, who is Professor of Human Rights Law and Director of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights at the London School of Economics. You have the floor.
And not only do I have the floor, but I have the chairman's watch. Now, one of the particular skills of a particularly boring speaker is to deprive the chair of the information on the basis of which he can draw the speech to a close. And there's an additional disadvantage I've just noticed. One of the ways in which you cope with particularly bad speech is you divert your eyes. But in this particular case, you get punished by an even closer look at myself. So I'll know why all eyes are on me, the alternative being even more gruesome. But all I can do apropos of this is to remind you that hope is manifest through patience, as we heard this morning. So you'll have an immediate chance to put this particular attribute into practice in the coming 2 or 3 hours. Actually, speaking of speeches, my most dramatic audience, an audience of this number, was made up of nurses. And I arrived in Brighton, and I was told that their conference had ended unexpectedly early. And it had been decided by some, I think, minor executive to move them into the dinner area well in advance of dinner. There had then been a panic, and it had been decided to distribute the wine in advance of the meal, some hours before the arrival of the meal. And I began my speech before 425 fairly inebriated nurses, 424 of them female. And I experienced, I believe the modern word is empathy, for the array of persons who've alleged in the past they've been subject to a rumbustious audience participation from male audiences. It was extraordinary. Your Eminence, Archbishop Martin, bishops, representatives of the other faiths, and colleagues, I am really pleased and touched to be invited to speak to you. And I want to particularly thank Bishop Field, but also Bishop Riley, whom I knew as a little boy in Granard in the 1960s when Father Riley was a curate. And the reason I'm particularly delighted to speak here is because of the topic and the subject. And the topic, my chosen topic, human rights, faith in a secular age, for a secular age. And the subject of our discussions is this encyclical, Deus Caritas Est. And I am pleased to be able to speak about that document because it has played a very important part in my life. It would be fair to say that there were some concerns among some about the succession to this extraordinarily important position. And they were not entirely allayed by the appointment or by the selection or by the emergence of Pope Benedict XVI, I have to be honest with you. I've written as much myself. And this document was an extremely moving document and extraordinarily powerfully written. And I have a copy which is like that, because an African priest, who's a Jesuit, who was studying for my master's in human rights at LSE, rushed me, as it were, this document. So proud was he of it, and so much did he feel that it did so much to provide foundations for what he saw as the joint endeavour between those concerned to achieve a better world through their commitment to a faith and those concerned to achieve a better world through their commitment to the idea of human rights. So my student, the Jesuit priest from Africa, saw this connection. And reading it, I was just amazed by the strength, breadth, power and humility of the language. So the opportunity to be able to speak about human rights, and also by reference to a document which certainly made me proud to be a member of the Roman Catholic Church, is an opportunity that's too good to miss. Now, some of what I'll be saying is a little bit critical. I sort of flagged that up, in a way. Bishop Field is beginning to laugh nervously. The press person is trying to remove RTE from the room. BBC is all right, we expect it. But the main message that I'm going to give in the 35 or so minutes that are left is a message about how these two great ideas of our time can work together. And I'm going to argue for that. And that's how the speech will end. But let me start with this notion of a secular age. There's just been a terrific book published by a very famous Canadian who happens also to be a Roman Catholic, Charles Taylor, which is called A Secular Age. And he, and I recommend it to any of you, it's a very long read, but a very rich read. He addresses the question, what is a secular age? And I want to start with that. And I want to say, with Taylor, but in the form of an anecdote, a secular age is where your child is the only child that goes to any kind of church service on a Sunday in his lovely progressive state school in North London. And a secular age is an age where it is not only not unusual not to be engaged in any kind of religious conduct, but where it is unusual to be engaged in some kind of religious conduct. Now, I don't know how much of that is the case in Ireland today. I know that things are changing. I don't know about Ireland. I do know that where I live, which is a community of tremendous richness, community support, collegiality, friendship and openness, with a mixture of classes and a mixture of ethnic groups and a warm, outgoing commitment to the other, which is something I've not experienced anywhere else, it is almost bizarre to go to church, any church. And it's actually thought to be slightly odd. And that, to me, is a secular society. A secular society is one in which I do not say in my lectures that I am a Catholic. I delivered a series of lectures in London, Durham, and, as it happens, Belfast, which were published. And they're called the Hamlin Lectures. And their title was, Can Human Rights Survive? And my lecture at LSE was a lecture on the limits of human rights, the crisis of what I call foundationalism, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a minute. And two learned professors, very able people, very bright people, distinguished emeritus professors, warm-hearted, well-read intellectuals, said, you cannot have human rights without religion. In fact, one of them stopped Diane, my wife, and said, you know, Conrad doesn't get it, you know, that you can't have this without religion. Diane said he's a Catholic, you know. I hadn't revealed it. And this man, Professor William Twining from UCL, who's a tremendous man, said, oh, I assumed he was kind of lapsed. And this is proving the point about the secular. He then put it in proofs in an article, which was published, a review, a symposium on these lectures. And I had this challenge to myself, whether I take it out, you see. And I didn't take it out. But there is a point here, which is that your credibility is, I will be crude, your credibility is damaged if you come across as a kind of Catholic, because then there's a sort of understanding that your perspective is dominated by a certain approach, which then diminishes your authority. Now, this human rights thing, you see, has this crisis of foundationalism because it can't work out where it comes from if it doesn't come from religion. That's the point of my two colleagues. And yet it knows it should be there because it delivers an apparent set of pragmatic and important answers to what we heard earlier described by His Eminence as a thirsting world. Or you could change the metaphor, but keep the idea of nutrition. A world hungry. A world hungry for a sense of right and wrong. So what I see every year are hundreds of people who apply to do my course who are indistinguishable from the kind of activists who gave us that brilliant Trokora piece just before my talk, but who would regard themselves as insulted if they were described as religious. So this is the kind of mystery I want to unravel, you see. Now, the human rights people, we human rights people, have had quite a lot of the same kind of challenges as the church. And I'm going to talk a little bit now about commonalities. The human rights idea has had this ambiguous relationship with freedom because it is very close to the idea of individual freedom. And indeed, a lot of its intellectual origins lie in the development of the idea that we have freedom and rights beyond the state, outside the state, in nature. But it's uneasy about the consequences of that, because the consequences of that are often thought by people to be kind of untrammeled capitalism, or thought to be the individual is all, or thought to be the anarchy of individualist greed. And there is a thread to human rights which morphs into a kind of libertarianism, which is about doing whatever you want. Now, human rights people are aware of the origins of that and uncertain about it. For the vast majority of human rights people, that is not what they mean by human rights. So the vast majority of human rights people are uneasy about the kind of individual freedom that just becomes the market is all. In fact, human rights people are distinguished for their criticism of capitalism, for their criticism of the untrammeled effects of the market. But similarly, human rights people have an uneasy relationship with socialism, with communism, because they see in Marx, it's a bit in this too, and in Salve, a great respect for the diagnostic power of Marx, which we forget at our peril, and a great awareness of the depth of moral indignation that originates in a true commitment to dignity, which allows somebody to write with anger about the effect of capitalism on individuals and families. But the human rights person then draws back because they see that ideologies of a better world destroy the world, to quote what we heard earlier this morning. So the human rights people have seen that earlier than a lot of people, earlier than me. Human rights people have been consistent in their awareness of the importance of the goals of socialism and communism, but great anxiety about the blank checks that are given to the powerful in the name of the people to achieve dignity at some moment in history. Human rights people have been on the right side of history in not backing that horse, just as they've not backed the capitalist horse. Now, the one for a long time that the human rights people backed and have to some extent really pinned their colours too, but it causes real problems of fit, is of course democracy. And democracy and human rights begin life very close together because they're each rooted in equality of esteem. What more effective way to show that you esteem a person than to give them the vote, than to give them the power to participate in society, whatever their colour, whatever their race, whatever their money, whatever their literacy? It's an extraordinary insight, incomprehensible to generations past. It's merely its success has made it seem normal. But what it then delivers is a kind of empty society where truth is the consequence of votes. And democracy, to which I'm completely committed, and where I absolutely am an unusual lawyer in that I oppose judges' rules and all sorts of this, that, and the other over it, but democracy fits postmodernism. And postmodernism is this notion that there is no right and wrong, there is no truth, there is only kind of whatever you agree. Now, I think there's an awful lot of power in that, I have to say, and that the language is limited. And democracy fits that because democracy seems to be saying that we define truth as whatever we've chosen for that moment. Now, human rights people are very, very nervous about that, for the same reasons that people who believe in fundamentals are nervous. Come back to that in a moment. So human rights has kind of tried to modify democracy by saying, well, it's not all just majority rule. There have to be some basic rules. And what are those basic rules? They turn out to be tolerance, pluralism. In other words, basic rules to allow people to have points of view, but not to have a point of view. So the only point of view becomes the point of view that people should have point of view. And so democracy, in its attempt to try and meet the problems of postmodernism without being so bad-mannered as to produce some kind of substance, ends up being kind of at risk of being completely empty. Now, and I think, by the way, that's what the Archbishop of Canterbury was talking about, was the narrowing of the space for religious expression in a world that is determined that no offence should be given, in a sort of speech that caused some trouble. The human rights people see there being more to democracy than that, you see. And the human rights people have an answer, you see. It's quite like the religious. They have an answer. They say, actually, there is a content to our system. The content is fundamental human rights. So they're very close, much closer than you might have imagined, to what we've been listening to, what we've read here, because they're eschewing capitalism, they're eschewing communism, they are uncertain of democracy, and they're pushing for fundamentals. Now, moving into the precise field of Deus Caritas Est, there is this big question of the neighbour, which has been mentioned. Now, the law answers who is my neighbour in a famous case in 1932, Donoghue and Stevenson, with the person who is so reasonably foreseeable by my actions that I ought to have them in mind when I act. It's a very, very important statement because it defines the tort of negligence. So I'm driving, somebody's on the side, I ought reasonably to have foreseen that if I drive badly, I will injure them. But it's a very narrow definition, you see. It's about people within your ambit. Now, the power of the language of human rights is identical to the power that is sought to be harnessed in Deus Caritas Est, because it tries to get us to see the neighbour as beyond not only our immediate family, the law does that, not only beyond those reasonably foreseeably affected by my actions, but into the world. But in doing that, it raises the question, which is raised directly in Deus Caritas Est, about how do you translate notions of neighbour into notions of justice? So a critical question is, how can we do more? Are we only being asked to engage in occasional acts of compassion? Human rights people are faced the same problem time after time after time. Is it an individual's ethical commitment which is manifest in conduct which is separate from the community and which is just reflective of their ethical goodness? Or is it a political program? Now, it seems to me that human rights has to be worked into a theory of justice, or it won't have the substance and the capacity to have permanent effect that we would desire for it. In other words, our belief in compassion, our belief in the other, our belief in doing good by the other, wherever it stands from, which I'll speak about in a moment, needs to be more than individual acts. And so human rights, just like the church, has to relate to politics. And what Pope Benedict says, the church cannot and must not take upon itself the political battle to bring about the most just society possible. She cannot and must not replace the state. A just society must be the achievement of politics, not of the church. Now, I say that the human rights movement is a vital part of the translation of the instinct for the other, which reflects the wide answer to the question, who is my neighbour, which reflects that instinct, and it's a vital part of the transformation of that answer into a political program, into a just society, not just acts. Look at the commonalities between human rights and the church. There is, obviously, a shared history. The international human rights movement is a creature of law since the Second World War, but its intellectual origins are in the Christian culture and the Christian tradition. The best early writer who sought to see that the other had rights despite his and her vulnerability, despite his and her helplessness, was a Dominican, Bartholomew de las Casas, who was writing about the plight of what we would now call the Native Americans, whose humanity had been rendered null by the marauding Catholic settlers, representative of the Spanish crown. And de las Casas, in defense of the Indians, as it's called in English, tries to get his readers to see that the Native Americans are human. Now, this to me is a classic human rights intervention. And you can provide lots of other examples. I just choose that one because it's pre what we call the Enlightenment. And the human rights movement is about getting us to see people as our neighbor, with all that follows from that. But as I've indicated, too, and importantly, and worth making as a separate point here, the human rights movement is about, it's about fundamentals. It stands outside postmodernism. It attempts to answer the question, who is my neighbor, with what it calls truth. Now, the Pope has a tremendous answer to this. Anyone who needs me and whom I can help is my neighbour. The concept of neighbour is now universalised, yet it remains concrete. Jesus identifies himself with those in need, with the hungry, the thirsty, the stranger, the naked, the sick, and those in prison. He does this in a fantastic way and in a competent way because of Jesus, you see, because of the belief. The human rights movement, and back to the point about the anxieties my colleagues had, seeks to get there without Jesus. Seeks to achieve the same outcomes without, in fact, it's the point of principle that it's without Jesus. So actually, there is great anxiety in the human rights movement. It grasps on to international human rights law. It grasps on to masks that it chooses to wear to avoid serious questions. It lives a life of compassion without knowing fully why it does. Now, I say, one of the things I do in my talks is I say, actually, the human rights movement can't go on like that indefinitely. human rights movement needs to confront why it believes in the other. And just parenthetically, I think there can be very robust arguments made from observations about nature. I won't go into them now, we haven't got the time, but I don't think that the human rights movement needs to crumble. I don't think the religious should crumble either in the face of criticisms such as those levelled against religion on the basis of Darwin. Arguing this little book, Can Human Rights Survive, that actually Darwin provides quite a lot for us about cooperation, about the importance of the instinct to help, how important this instinct is to the development of the species, and how, above all now, it hardly beholds anybody to argue that the survival of the fittest is the route to human success. So I think the jury is out on that, and I think religion is far too defensive on Darwin, as is the human rights movement. It's worth just reminding ourselves the famous American William Jennings Bryan lampooned for his criticism of Darwin at the Scopes trial. And of course it was somewhat foolish in historical retrospect, but he was attacking what was called social Darwinism, the survival of the fittest, to the rich and the powerful, the bounties of society. So we actually, as a human rights and religious group, can muster our forces to challenge some of the ready assumptions about Darwin, which lead into criticisms of human rights and criticisms of religion. Now, a belief in the dignity of the other, whether rooted in Jesus or rooted in wonder at the evolution or rooted in whatever it is in practice a fight for the underdog. It's that in practice, because the rich and powerful don't need us to protect their dignity. It's well protected by the police, by gates, by the power of money. It's the poor that need protection, the vulnerable, the marginalized, the oppressed. That is exactly the area that the human rights group and the church work together. Just concluding this section, there are extraordinary further sociological similarities. We had before this picture a candle. Now you'll know that the Amnesty International symbol is the candle. And there's a very interesting sociological book written on Amnesty International, and it's called Keepers of the Flame. And the man who wrote it, an excellent man at SOAS, says that basically his way of understanding Amnesty is it's a religious organization. It has a mission. It has texts. It has a hierarchy. And there are people who look at the human rights movement and they say it's constructed like a religious movement. And it sends its missionaries abroad. All of the people I receive into my class are people who've worked in Africa, worked in South America. We get so many applications, we can look for not only academic excellence, but also evidence of commitment to the other. And each tries to influence politics, interestingly. The church occasionally tries to inform debate, but so does the human rights group, with their Human Rights Watch reports, with their interventions, and they get as cross when members of one of their organizations does not take the human rights line on something. Reminds us exactly of the church. You have people who say, I'm a card-carrying member of Amnesty, but I've decided to go to China. Same sort of thing that Catholic MPs say in the United Kingdom when voting in a particular direction. So it's extraordinary how connected the two are. Now, let's get to tensions. But time's running out, you'll be relieved to hear, Bishop Field. You can pull Joe Little back in. General proposition, there is not enough space on the progressive and ethical side of our culture these days to have squabbles between people who share so much in common. That's my general proposition. The Cold War is over. Socialism seems to have gone away for a long time. Capitalism is arrogantly rampant, and we can't squabble. That's my general proposition. What do we talk about squabble? There is a difference, let's face it, a difference of application. It is not a difference of principle between the human rights movement and the Catholic Church, among other churches. I don't believe it is. But there are definite tensions in application. Very briefly, an obvious one is life. the start and end of life. There are major differences of application. There is no argument about dignity and respect for dignity. There is discussion about when it kicks in and when it comes to an end. And extremely thoughtful, warm-hearted, intelligent people say at both ends of the spectrum that there is a different role for the ethical, engaged citizen. A second one, reading Deus Caritas Est, I have to say that when I hear Archbishop Martin in his marvellous address talk about no discrimination in love and address the person in his or her completeness, I can only report to you that my colleagues in the world of human rights, who've been drawn into this subject often by their commitment to gay rights, their commitment to transsexuals, without necessarily being gay and without necessarily being transsexual, it is what's drawn them in, would not recognise that completeness in the document. And do not see, I have to say, a reason why the love that is so beautifully elaborated should be so restricted. That's what they would say. And that is a tension. And a third area of tension, one that dramatically affects a lot of my students because they are drawn into it from their own life experiences, is the issue of gender. And gender to them is linked to power, and they would say that the Catholic Church's structures are not respectful of what they would think of as human rights of women. I report that. I do not report that in order to elaborate tensions. I do not report that in order to say the two cannot meet. I report that to conclude with an initiative. I only saw a short report on this in the Tablet. I'm a trustee of the Tablet, so I have to get the Tablet plug in every... Tablet is an international Catholic weekly, which has brilliant occasional speakers on an annual basis, Archbishop, I think, doesn't it? A report about this global trust. And it said a couple of interesting things. It said the faith trust in the church has gone up in Ireland. From 29 to 37%. That is extraordinarily significant in a short period and is a tribute to the leadership in this church as well as its members, if I may say so. But it also said that trust in NGOs is at 59%. So there's a major trust opportunity here. And what's the opportunity? The opportunity, I think, is listening to His Eminence this morning, reminding ourselves of two points he made. To be generous in every way to people we don't agree with, and to show us how to be open-minded so that we can learn from each other. Applied to the human rights people as much as to the church. This is not one-way traffic. This is not one-way traffic. Generous in every way to people we don't agree with, show us how to be open-minded so that we can learn from each other. And I think we could do that by creating a forum for discussion. And the forum for discussion might be modelled on what has been very successful in the north of Ireland, a way of managing difference. A forum that does not go in to deliver agreement on everything. A forum that is committed to two things. One is achievement of common ground, which will be quite straightforward, in my opinion, and empowering to each element. And secondly, and give rise to the growing sense of solidarity we heard reference to. And secondly, dialogue on difference. Because I think both communities could benefit by an interchange. And that dialogue is not intended to produce agreement. That's the important point, I think. That's a search too much and too far and doesn't acknowledge the international nature of both organisations, the international human rights movement and the Roman Catholic Church. But a dialogue on difference. Now, I happen to believe, personally, that issues like, for example, abortion are extremely difficult for human rights people. And I think that there are lots of things that can be said in both directions on quite a lot of issues, like assisted dying. The important point I'm making is that the development of the common ground should not be obscured by too much noise around the issues of difference, but that the issues of difference should be ventilated, and then a way should be made of accommodating them in a way which preserves the energy of both sides. And what that would lead to, in my opinion, or what it could lead to, what the goal could be, working goal, would be a kind of new concordat, a new statement of joint aims, and a new way of integrating civil society and religion in a secular age. A secular age which is looking for something. A secular age which, to paraphrase Bob Geldof's book, is looking around and saying, is that it? And the answer is, it's not it. And this agreement between the international human rights community and the church could be an agreement that respects difference, but moves ahead on commonalities, and each side is enriched by listening to the other as well as articulating their position. Now, the Pope, the author of this marvellous encyclical, has focused an awful lot on Europe and on the need to reintegrate a kind of faith perspective into European culture and society. And I don't read this document as his saying back to pre-modernism. And I don't read it as saying the optimum is church rule. I don't at all. So something like this must be the kind of thing that he has in mind. And my very last observation is he did a brilliant dialogue as Cardinal Ratzinger with Jürgen Habermas, who's a very distinguished German philosopher. And this was an interaction in which two men committed to the goal of dignity from widely different perspectives addressed together how to achieve it. And I think that's the kind of model for the kind of Europe for which we should all work. Thank you very much.
We'll be having questions on both sessions after our second intervention today. I'd like to assure you that I have received my watch back. this is a fascinating discussion for me particularly because I spent many, many years in this type of dialogue in the halls of the UN where you were trying to have a dialogue with the human rights community and religious people and states, who then are another component in that. The only parallel groups that you didn't mention are the fundamentalists, because you have fundamentalist human rights people who would not be prepared to enter into this dialogue, and we have fundamentalists who will only accept neo-theocracies in today's world. It's also particularly coloured by a very unusual situation that you find in the United States. Now, our second speaker this morning is Lucy Fallon Brown, who's director of the National Center for Partnership and Performance, particularly involved in looking at innovative ways of bringing partnership into work. I apologize for not recognizing that you were also a school principal. I only read that after I had made my remarks.
Well, following the last speaker, Conor was talking about Granard. When I was growing up in Galway in the 1960s in a place called Dunmore, any vision or any dream I had about Croke Park started with Is more on honour thumsa on Curranshaw Glocka or son Winshire na Galiva. That was when Galway was in its heyday and they won the All-Ireland finals in 1964, 65 and 66. And all the Donlans and the stars of that team came from Dunmore. So that's just a little plug from my hometown. So I think it's appropriate for me to begin to say that it is indeed an honour and a privilege and a pleasure to address this conference today on this very inspiring topic. And I have to say, when I was asked to do this, I questioned whether or not I would or in what capacity I would treat the subject. But I did read the encyclical, and certainly I found that it has great relevance to the work that we do in the National Centre for Partnership and Performance, as indeed great relevance for all our personal lives and our lives in many respects. And to begin with, I suppose, I was heartened when I read it that the idea of every generation having to look at its responsibilities and to take up its responsibilities anew. Because I suppose the perception that we might have sometimes of the church is that it's slow to change. And I'm sure many of you would agree with me when we think of the church, we don't often think of areas like strategic planning or being a very flexible, dynamic, innovative organisation. So I very much welcomed the idea of saying, let's take up these challenges anew. And that's mentioned several times throughout the encyclical. And, particularly that opening quotation there, building a just and social and civil order, wherein each person receives what is his or her due, is an essential task which every generation must take up anew. And obviously when I looked at that, I said, well, what are the particular challenges in our workplaces today and in our organisations today? Clearly there are the challenges of globalisation and intense competition, intense innovation and rapid change, the challenges of technology, the challenges of diversity, the challenges of integrating many different nationalities, particularly here in Ireland now for the first time in our workplaces. And recently, I suppose, the challenges of the obscene salaries of people in certain sectors, particularly of the private sector, and the increasing inequality of what people are paid in workplaces. And I think that has come to the fore very recently in the social partnership process, and we're very aware of that. So there are very significant challenges, and our responsibility is to take these challenges up anew. So I'm going to talk about the work of the centre, and just in case you might think the NCPP might mean the National Centre for Car Parks, as somebody called us recently, I think I had better explain what the National Centre for Partnership and Performance does. Or as somebody related to Peter Castle called it at one stage, the National Centre for the Pirates of Penzance. So that'll help you remember that there are two P's in it. I'm going to talk about, I suppose, some of the images that we have of organisations and the things that might really confine us in our thinking and might inhibit us in becoming more caring at work and building more humane and caring organisations at work, because we have very big baggage and we have very big legacies of organisations which come from a long way back. And then I will move towards some of the work that the centre has done with the social partners, and we're working under the umbrella of social partnership under the Department of the Taoiseach and working closely with the social partners. And I think whilst we're not there yet, we're getting there, and I think we're moving on a journey which would be very much in line with the sentiments that are expressed in Deus Caritas Est. And I will reflect that throughout the conversation and throughout this input today. And finally, I suppose, to say that I think we are moving now in the knowledge economy, and we're moving to a space in organisations and in workplaces where the business case and the moral case are converging. I mean, that is a huge task, and that's a huge challenge for us. But I think the work, a lot of the research that we have done as a centre, we're saying that the best workplaces are those where people are treated well and treated fairly, because the knowledge economy and the innovative economy is about people. It's about their ideas, it's about their creativity, their ambitions for their organisations. And we won't get that level of success and that level of innovation unless we treat people well and value them. So just a little bit of background. We were established in 2001 and we're now part of a group of organisations which work in the social partnership area. You're probably familiar with the NESC, the National Economic and Social Council, and the NESF, the National Economic and Social Forum. And we all work together. There are three organisations working together under now what is called the NESDO. I know that's a lot of nationals, and sometimes when people ring us up, I get worried that by the time they've heard about all the bodies that start with national, they might give up on us. But our mission in particular is to promote partnership-led change and innovation in Irish workplaces. So it's a very exciting organisation, and certainly for me a very exciting organisation to lead, because we have tremendous scope. We work with the public and the private sector. We do a lot of promotional activities. And we work, I suppose, at the better end of the whole field of industrial relations. We try to promote best practice. and break new ground in terms of leading people towards that new practice, and it is a very exciting place to be. Now, if this looks like an ecclesiastical diagram, it's not that it was developed for today. A lot of my colleagues, this is the essence of our new strategic plan, which was launched by the Taoiseach last year, and a lot of my colleagues accuse me of borrowing this from Gardiner Street Church, because sometimes when at lunchtime, when to get away from the frenzy of the workplace and the organisation, I go down to Gardiner Street Church, which is a beautiful, beautiful place and beautiful church. And I often find, looking at the altar there, I get inspiration. So it might have been just unknowingly that this became our summary of our strategy. And our mission really is very ambitious: to lead and support workplace transformation and change in Ireland through partnership. And through the work that we've done on the Forum on the Workplace of the Future, which I will talk about later, we've identified that we need to really improve our capacity for change in Irish organisations and Irish workplaces. We need to build a much greater commitment to innovation in the workplace. In Ireland, if you think about it, we put a lot of work into innovation in research and development. And when you hear ministers and speakers talking about innovation in Ireland, they tend to talk about research and development. But it's a lot more than that. We need innovation in every workplace in Ireland if we are to truly compete with the international competition that is out there. And we need, to balance that, we need to have a very high quality place of work for all of us, where people's creativity is maximised, but also where people will stay in work as they get older, because like all of the other societies in Europe, we are an ageing population. And our work then runs across those pillars, which is about partnership, about moving on with the National Workplace Strategy, which I will talk to you about. We've also been given, thankfully, an innovation fund by the government to help us move these ideas and to incentivise organisations to draw down monies to support this kind of change. We do a lot of research and policy development, and it's on the basis of that research and that evidence that we promote our activities through communication. And obviously the whole context in where we work is a changing workforce, a dramatically changing workforce in the last number of years, and the intensive globalisation that's happening around us, but moving towards a more knowledge-intensive economy and more knowledge-intensive workplaces. But I'm just going to go back for a moment and take us through maybe what the images of organisations we might have and where we've borrowed from the past, if you like. I suppose if you reflect on the organisation that you work in, I will share with you now some images. What kind of metaphors would you use to describe those organisations? And sometimes I think we're a little bit, I suppose, you know, confined by the legacy of organisations that have come through from the past. And I talk about the two Fredericks, Frederick the Great of Prussia, who developed a very stylized manner of military organisation, but this other Frederick, who was very unpopular and very much maligned in his time, and yet has had an enormous influence on how we work in organisations. And I bet even as we speak, many of your organisations are very hierarchical organisations with very sophisticated organisation charts showing where people are positioned, etc. And that all comes from this idea of scientific management and the whole Frederick Taylor philosophy of how organisations work. And it brought great productivity, but sadly, it looked at people as machines. Now, we are moving away from that kind of a model because we're moving away from an industrial model to more knowledge-based, but we still have a large number of our organisations are based on that model, sadly. And if we think that we have moved sufficiently away from it, I suppose we should think of the kind of globalised companies that have quite a lot of political power and authority, but without really any accountability. And many of their mechanisms, while they might be dressed up in very sophisticated human resource management practices, many of them really do regard their people and they work in a machine-like way. But just to expand out, and as I said, to get you to reflect on maybe where your own organisation might be sitting or where organisations in general might be seen better through metaphors, Gareth Morgan has this idea that looking at the history of organisations and workplaces. And I think it's a very provocative, very good way to try and start examining really what is going on in our organisations and workplaces and, you know, how we might think. And he looks at organisations as machines, as organisms, as brains. And I think that's probably the more appropriate of the organisation types that we would be looking at, and we'd be going beyond that. Organisations as learning organisations, as communities where people participate, where they learn, where they're valued, where they're respected. organizations as political systems, as he goes further in terms of psychic prisons, where we're all bounded by the confines of the culture and the organizational structures that surround us, organizations as flux and transformation, and then that idea of organizations as instruments of domination. And it's again that idea that we work in sometimes very powerful multinational organizations. Sometimes they are caring and they have caring cultures, other times they don't. And even the very idea of an organization comes from the Greek word, which is organon, meaning a tool or an instrument. So when we're working in workplaces and organizations, we should be reminded that we really are borrowing a lot from the past, and perhaps borrowing a lot from an industrial era that really is not consistent with what we would be desiring of having today. And again, when we look at some of the images of organisations, I think of some of the people who might work in places like McDonald's. And Lucy Kellaway, who writes in the Financial Times and in the Irish Times, is often very provocative about these things. And she talks about the kind of manuals that people who work in these places are given. You know, if you go into McDonald's and you ask for a hamburger, you know, the fact that you get a smile is not because it's spontaneous, it's because you're required to smile. There is a smile, it is a sincere greeting, there is eye contact. Imagine working to that kind of prescription. It is not really human, it's not possible to do that. But Lucy puts it very well, and she says, the shop assistant was well trained and was following all the instructions to the letter. Yet simply by doing it right, she was doing it wrong. Delight cannot be made through formula. And much of where, you know, many of the norms in terms of advanced human resource management, or whatever you'd like to call it, they do sometimes work like that. There is a lack of spontaneity, a lack of humanity, a lack of being an individual and really giving of yourself and having your own personality. And again, just I suppose to further this point, Madeleine Bunting, and I see David Begg is here. I know David talks about Madeleine Bunting's view of the world, where she is seriously worried about the sustenance and the sustainability of human nature if we continue to work as hard and in an intensified way as we do. Because many people who are really in the throes of working in their organisation are so under pressure that they have no time for caring responsibilities for their children, for their parents. And I often say to people who work, you know, all the hours God sends and who are there until late in the evening, who is looking after your caring responsibilities? Because we all have caring responsibilities. So this overwork culture and this intensification of work is really a big threat, I think, to the kind of ideas that are set out in this encyclical. And I think it's one of the biggest challenges that we face in taking up this challenge anew. I think we should be mindful of it. But moving on from this idea, as I mentioned earlier, we are moving towards greater communities of organisations and towards, hopefully, more learning organisations. As this quotation from Dr. Peter Senge puts it, the best companies in the knowledge economy operate as learning organisations where innovators work in teams, enjoy ease of communication with each other, have access to new outside knowledge, and are able to generate new knowledge and apply new knowledge. And one of the greatest challenges, I think, in building this kind of innovation is to how to generate new knowledge, but also how to find ways of sharing it in the workplace itself. So I'm going to go on now and talk to you about the work that we have done in the centre, and I know Conor mentioned earlier about setting up a forum in a different context, but we're back in 2003, we were asked by the government to establish a forum on the workplace of the future. And that forum did exactly what Conor was talking about in terms of his proposition for a forum. It looked at, together, all of the different aspects of workplaces, and it tried to set out a vision for our workplaces for the future from all of the different parties, everybody having a different point of view, but trying to reach a common consensus in the face of all the challenges that were ahead of us. But some of the research from the forum I'll share with you very briefly now, although there's a lot of rich information in it, and you can certainly get it on our website. We conducted a survey in 2004 on changing behaviours and attitudes in our workplaces, and we're going to run it again now in 2008. It's a national workplace survey, the biggest workplace survey that has ever been conducted in workplaces in Ireland. And some of the statistics from it really surprised us. Now, if you think of people working in organisations, and one of the basic requirements of anybody who's working in a job is to get information. And if you think about it, if you don't get information that's relevant to you, in your area of work, well, then you're not very well respected and your dignity is not very well appreciated. And for example, we found that very large numbers of people in work don't get basic information that concerns them, that is important to them. And if you look there at the very last one, up to 52% of employees in the private sector said they do not get information and they do not know what the sales and profit figures of their organisation are. So really that asks the question, you know, how are they treated in the workplace and how, you know, how can that really sit with the fact that we are trying to get all our people to work together and trying to build more innovative communities and trying to be more competitive and more successful at work. And right, looking right across this in terms of they don't know what the competition is, they don't know about changing work practices, they don't know, 58% don't know about company reorganisation, for example. And that's one important, I suppose, indicator of how people are treated at work. And equally in terms of whether people are consulted. Now, they're consulted about areas that affect their work. Very large numbers said that there were almost 13% almost never consulted, 15% rarely, sometimes. So we're not getting information and we're not being consulted, we're not being valued, we're not being treated as we should be treated in our workplaces in Ireland in general terms. And just reflecting on what has been said already, anyone who needs me and whom I can help is my neighbour. Well, are we helping those people who are working with us if we don't give them basic information, if we don't consult them on areas that affect their own jobs? Are we giving them the opportunities that they need to live fulfilled lives and to gain meaning and fulfilment at work? And again, it says that the church has a duty to interpret ever anew this relationship to the actual daily life of its members. And what can be more important in the daily life of the members of the church or in any community than where they work and how they are treated at work? Secondly, when we found, as well as information and consultation, we found that people were treated quite differently depending on where they were in the workplace and the level of educational qualifications that they had. In fact, the single biggest variable in terms of how people were treated at work was their level of educational qualifications. And I think this echoes again what Conor said. If you have a high level of education and you're in a senior position in your workplace, you're treated well. You get information, you're consulted, and surprisingly, you get twice as much training as those people who do not have high levels of education and who are in the lower ranks, we'll say, of the organisation hierarchy. And when we were conducting the work on the Forum of the Workplace of the Future, the people who were most vocal in terms of sending in submissions and who were trying to be heard were people with disabilities. People with disabilities not only are not treated well at work, but they have been denied access to workplaces. And I was at a conference recently on people with disabilities, and I was very taken by the fact and saddened by the fact that their biggest concern was whether or not they would disclose their disability at an interview. That is the big concern of people with disabilities. Isn't that a very sad state for us to be in? People with many abilities, with great talents to offer, and research would show that they are probably the most loyal and the most dedicated of workers, and yet we do not even allow them into the workplace. And when we do, mind you, we find that they're not being promoted. They tell us that they're not being promoted. We also find people like lone parents, working mothers, etc., have difficulty accessing the workplace. Foreign nationals and all the difficulties that we're experiencing there are very highly publicised cases. So we will be looking at that very closely in our 2008 survey to see how foreign nationals are really being integrated. And it strikes me, for example, that in the public service, there's quite a small number of people who are integrated into the public service from other countries, where they seem to be concentrated in certain industries and in certain sectors. And we really have to change that if we want to have successful integration policies in the future. Those with lower level qualifications, as I said, part-time workers are treated differently to full-time workers, and certainly those in lower paid jobs. So we're saying that there is effectively a knowledge divide or an opportunities divide in our workplaces. And how do we counter this? What I would suggest is that we look towards what the outcomes of that forum were in terms of where our workplaces are going. And the Taoiseach and the Department of the Taoiseach and the government have launched a national workplace strategy to position our workplaces, not just economically but socially, for the future. And the five key priorities in that strategy are building greater commitment to workplace innovation, obviously to drive our economy forward in a knowledge economy, building greater capacity for change, developing future skills, improving access to opportunities. It seems extraordinary that even though we're almost a full economy, we're very little, in recent years we've had very little unemployment, we still are creating really serious barriers of access to many communities in our society and improving the quality of working life. So I think it's a fairly balanced framework from which to move forward and to reflect some of the ideas that the Pope's encyclical has set out for us in Deus Caritas Est. And going further then, the vision that was created for the workplace of the future has two overarching principles. One is that we would develop very fit, very flexible organisations in Ireland, whether it's in the private or the public sector, but that those organisations would be responsive to people's needs and they would be responsive to the needs of workers. And I think it's quite helpful and I suppose quite hopeful that we would have a framework like that from which to move on. Many countries in Europe now are coming to examine this national workplace strategy to see how they can develop such a strategy in their own countries, and we had a recent visit from people from Finland who are very progressive in terms of workplaces and they were very taken with this overall plan. Now it's very difficult to implement it because it covers the workplace right across the board, from innovation right across to childcare, to access issues, to quality of work-life issues, dispute resolution. Every aspect of the workplace, practically, that you can imagine, is in that strategy in one way or another. And we hope, perhaps in a year or two's time, to review it and to see how far we... There's a high-level implementation group there to implement it, to see how many of these aspects and recommendations have been moved on. But I think it's a powerful framework in Ireland for which to move our workplaces forward in a more equitable and a fairer way. And just to move on to the idea then that is underpinning all of this, we're not going to get, I suppose, to those higher levels of workplace performance and greater levels of innovation without involving everybody. And we have done a huge amount of research in the centre about the benefits and the power of partnership. And I would ask you to maybe check our website to get those studies that we have conducted in many different sectors in our economy. And we also have looked at the international evidence. And it seems that if people work in a partnership culture, a truly partnership culture, which accommodates learning, which accommodates diversity, accommodates involvement, and rewards people for effort, that there are gains not just for the organisation, but there are gains for the employees, and that there is a very strong business case for that way of working. And some of the areas that we have highlighted in terms of the benefits and the power of partnership would be that you get increased levels of innovation, you get greater levels of flexibility from your employees and your workforce, and you get an acceptance of change, which is very hard to get without that culture, without that spirit of partnership. You get greater levels of commitment, lower levels of absenteeism. And when you empower people and give them more control over their lives and over the times they work, you tend to get much higher levels of commitment for them. Also, we promote the idea of employee financial involvement. And many organisations now are looking at innovative ways of rewarding employees through innovative forms of employee financial involvement. Because I suppose the old system whereby everybody was on a very set salary and there was no flexibility in that really doesn't pay people for the kind of commitment and the kind of energy that they put into the more partnership types of organisations. So there are many innovative ways of rewarding employees, even financially, for that level of commitment. And then you build up an awful lot more trust and commitment and employee security in that model as well. So partnership in the past, I think, was seen as a set of structures, and maybe perhaps it was looked on as a kind of a talking shop where unions and management sat down and they got tied up in knots over various intricate issues. Well, that's not the case anymore. It is a very dynamic concept now, which does accommodate areas, as I said, like much greater levels of learning, diversity, greater levels of flexibility, as long as there is a dialogue and a culture and a conversation going on between the partners, the employers, and the employees themselves in different ways. Because I think it's put very well here, Peter Drucker says, organisations are no longer built on force, but on trust. And indeed, I think we have found to our cost in the past that many the cost of mistrust is enormous indeed. If you think of, even for example, if you look at the hurling team now, the Cork hurling team, I would just like to see how they're going to perform in the championship or in the league this year, because the cost of mistrust, the cost of conflict, and the cost of strife of that nature is just really enormous. So the opposite, I think, is not really an option. And I think we have to be careful that we recognise an adversarial model is very, very costly indeed in terms of the way forward. Now, just to finish, I think, again, I'm highlighting some of the areas that were highlighted already. If you think about how we give of ourselves at work and we give of our talents and our ideas and our energy, we cannot really be expected to be truly high-performing at work and be giving of our best if we're only treated as machine-like objects and if we're not treated in a humane way. Because, as the encyclical says, man is truly himself when his body and soul are intimately united. And only when both dimensions are truly united does man attain his full stature. And as the bishop said, my own background was as a teacher and a primary school principal. And I remember when you're working hard as a teacher, and it's a very, very difficult job and very intensive job every day, I remember I was very inspired by Brian McMahon's quotation, and I think it applies to all of the walks of life that we're talking about. He said, a good teacher is a good person teaching. And if you apply that to anything, a good employer is a good employer managing, or a good employee is a good employee who is a good worker. So I think I will leave you with that quotation, because I know that the bishop is going to get his back on me as a school principal if I don't finish quickly. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that. Those reflections. A very interesting understanding of the importance of enhancement of people in the workplace, and how enhancing people in the workplace can also have these concrete effects, like even efficiency and so on. I just say that we should also, in our reflection, look at the other side, and namely, what is poverty? That poverty isn't lack of economic opportunity. It's the inability to realise God-given potential. And the more we look at poverty, the more we should be looking at that dimension, and that the way to overcome poverty is through investing in people and through enabling them to be enhanced in their work. And this is, again, a bridge, I think, between a human rights reflection and a reflection on work. Though it always strikes me unusual that, for example, the Millennium Development Goals, which emerge to a great extent from a human rights reflection, there's none of them addressed to the theme of work, which is, in the fight against poverty, probably something that is quite essential. I suppose one of the reasons is that the Millennium Development Goals were developed in a government, an intergovernmental framework, whereas now work is seen more and more as being generated by the private sector. But this means we have to come together into a partnership of all those involved, private sector, governments, NGOs, people of faith, so that we can have that integrated role of partnership. Before going on to the questions, I have to make a personal admission that I have only in my entire life been on that side of Croke Park, in other words, in the stadium, on two occasions. The first was for the closing mass of the Patrician Congress in 1961. And the second time was at a concert given by Bono. Now, we have got a good half hour for questions. Can I maybe take three questions together so that we'd be able to answer? I see a hand raised here before I even have the opportunity. We have microphones. Can I ask you to be reasonably quick?
Well, I suppose just one question about the whole theme. It's wonderful, particularly that God is love. In our Christian tradition, and it talks about humans in social relationships, but then it tends to forget that unless we are grounded in ecological relationships, that we won't survive. And just thinking of it from, if you ask the question of who is my neighbour from the Franciscan tradition, they will say yes, it's about caring for the neighbour like caring for the leper, but it is also caring for all of creation today. And these are the kind of issues that the last speaker spoke about. This is the challenge today. And people in the church are speaking about it. Cardinal Brady spoke about climate change in his Christmas address, and it was almost apocalyptic. But it's outside this sort of seamless garment. And if this was included, I think I'd finish with the words of one of our great sports pundits, that this is a really great document, but it would be a really, really great document if the wider Franciscan neighbour was included. Thank you.
Any further over the side?
Yeah. Vincent McBriarty on the Commission. Though the question of ethics was implicit in much of what was said in the last talk, it wasn't mentioned explicitly. And I think that in the next decade, the whole question of ethics in the workplace is going to define so much. We've seen so many of the great industries collapse in recent years because they lost sight of ethics and put greed in front of that. So I was somewhat surprised that there wasn't some major emphasis on the whole question of ethics in work and permeating the workplace.
Yeah. And the third question here.
Yeah, I found...
Can you identify yourself, please?
I'm Father Jerry O'Hanlon in the Jesuit Centre for Faith and Justice. Just to say, I mean, I found Deus Caritas as a very generous kind of document, and the two speakers this morning resonated with that, and I'm very appreciative of what they said. Taking up the point about the forum between human rights activists and the church, I think that's an extraordinarily stimulating kind of idea, but I do think it would be helped... if the church itself was able to address some of the issues that you mentioned within the church. I know that's a very difficult thing to do, but the kind of intellectual generosity that's in this document, and if I might say, the kind of leadership we're getting in the church now and at the moment is generous, but those issues of life, of sexuality, of gender, they're issues which the church itself finds very hard to discuss. And Cardinal Bernardine did it some years ago in Chicago, that idea of the common ground, which would allow for difference. And I agree entirely that we've more in common, both with human rights activists and then within the church, those were, if you like, on the right and the left wing. But there's a kind of a blanket of silence around these whole things. And I don't think that kind of repression is good. And I don't think just the elephant in the cupboard syndrome, which I think is there, is healthy or helpful. And the credibility of the church in entering into dialogue with human rights organizations is damaged if it can't dialogue within itself.
Okay, can we have the microphones on the table working? Yeah, or would you... Sure. Okay. Well, this is working, certainly. Which of you would like to answer some of the questions? Donal, you're also welcome to join in the panel. Yeah?
Thanks very much, Ashby. I'll take the first and the third very quickly, although I think the third from Father Jerry is kind of a comment, and I appreciate for each, I did allude to this in my talk, for each group there is an international dimension which makes it quite difficult, I think, but... I'm invited to a country in Africa next month, and I thought I was going to have to perform, and I asked them what they wanted. Well, actually, they want to use me as a kind of way of talking between themselves. So a forum can be a place where the opportunity comes to talk to yourselves as well. So I wouldn't knock it. If the atmosphere is right, you can talk across the table in a way that mightn't be the case otherwise. So it wouldn't be a reason for ruling it out, in my opinion. I think Vincent's will be, I think, dealt with by you, actually. That's that second one. And I think the first is, of course, a crucial one. Absolutely. It's good that it was mentioned. And there is a really big challenge for us all where all these ethical ideas fit, actually. I did a paper at Queen Mary College saying that animal rights actually was the subject and that human rights was a subset of animal rights. And what I was trying to do was get environmental issues into this subject area. Now, the risk with that, I have to say, to speak against myself and to echo some of the critics, if you try and make an idea do too much work, it collapses in itself. And sometimes we do commit the error of seeking to load our ethical agenda with everything that we think is important, when in fact sometimes maybe what we need to do is say this is our bit, and we do our bit rather well, and we make sure it doesn't damage the other bits. And of course we have. I think the human-centric dimension to human rights has been historically damaging, and that would need to be acknowledged, but we don't do it anymore, and then let others carry on.
I've got a conference in LSE on the 26th of April, which is called Humans and Habitats, where I've brought in Friends of the Earth and Human Rights Watch, and we have some very, very good speakers from LSE intellectuals in the field, and we're trying to work out what the common space is and how the human rights and the environmental people can work together. But I'm not absolutely convinced that we incorporate the environmental within our field.
Just respond in relation to the comment about ethics. I mean, I take your point. I didn't explicitly mention it, but I presume that you agree that it was implicitly mentioned in almost everything I said. You see, the difficulty with dealing with an issue like that and the big high-profile cases like Enron or whatever is that we believe that if you have good systems at work where people are involved and they share information and they are consulted and there is a real culture and a philosophy of partnership in the organisation, that those systems, those things simply won't happen, because part of the problem in terms of ethics is that the certain power and information and the I suppose the levers of how the organisation is developing or going, they're all concentrated in the hands of a few. So our whole philosophy would be that in moving towards more modern, more innovative workplaces, that everybody needs to have a say and their part needs to be recognised and they need to have a contribution. So I think rather than just talking about a big theme like ethics, we were talking about the particular manner in which the workplace is organised and how it's managed and the particular aspects in concrete terms of what can be done to make that happen. But I agree with you totally. I mean, it is a central point in the whole question of how organisations are performing today, and there are many, many, many big challenges and big scandals still in existence that we have to deal with. But our role, I think, is to further the interests of everybody involved in the workplace and to ensure that they do get the right information, that they are consulted and that they're involved and they're given opportunities to develop and to learn.
Do you want to? Well, I just say that I think there is and there needs to be a theology of human rights. Because I think that maybe is a question that underlies a lot of what we're talking about. The real question is not so much who is my neighbour, but what is a person? And I think part of the difficulty is, both in ethics and in human rights, is that people are discussing them who don't really have the same deep understanding of who a person is. There's the famous statement that was made at the time of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights that we were all agreed on this, provided nobody asked us why. And I think the question of why is actually what the church has to contribute to this discussion. And I would very much agree on the need for some kind of forum and some kind of discussion of those things between human rights people and the church.
I think also we'd have to say that probably today we wouldn't get the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, because there are too many whys have now arisen. And the possibility to generate that extraordinary document came through the shock of a war. After the shock of war, it's easier to build consensus and it's easy to see the importance of multilateralism. The farther you go away from that, the more you become unilateral. I would say there are models for the type of dialogue we're talking about. Conflict resolution models, or sheer diplomacy. Many people look on diplomacy as a sort of a magic wand in which you resolve problems. Diplomacy is the task of filing down difference in a spirit of trust. And if you do that, then you can arrive at assessing levels of consensus and difference and living with it. Did you want to come back on?
Well, I don't want to too much, but personhood is a key example of where very well-meaning human rights people would see a personhood in a different way and would lead to quite important decisions. Like my colleague next door to me will say you can operate on people in a vegetative state, you know, because they've ceased to be persons. And he's a well-meaning person. He's very committed to goodwill and so on. And so there'd be fascinating interactions there where both sides actually would engage. On the Universal Declaration, you know, there was no enforcement mechanism. So even in 1948, the agreement was bought at a price, and the price was that it remain a declaration. And then you look at what happened next. Well, they weren't able to decide upon an international bill of rights until 1966. Then there were two, one for the Americans and one for the Soviets, and neither was properly enforceable. In other words, even then, the reality of the crystallization of these ideas in practice was recognized as difficult.
Good. Can we take another round of questions? Please identify yourself. Yeah.
I'm Anne Codd from Pastoral Development. I have a question for Conor, and it is in relation to his espousal within limitations of democracy as a social system. My question is, have you reflections to offer on the resources from within faith communities for the growth of discernment as an alternative to the majority rule ethic of democracy?
Martin, you have somebody there, yeah?
Magella McCarron, OLA Justice and Peace. I think I've been challenged by what the speakers have in very practical ways within my ambit of work. I'm faced every week with redundancies from big multinational organisations, and there is a contradiction there between building trust and then smashing trust at a week's notice. So that's a real problem for me. The second one is the esteem of the person, that I like that phrase. I'm thinking of the asylum seeker who has been 4 years without any attention, who is still living on €19 a week. And I reckon it is the most powerless act, from my experience of speaking to these people. Every other part of society gets a rise every year, even if it's €1. Since 2000, this group of people haven't got one penny's increase on €19, whatever it is. And it's not the money, it's what we're doing to these people by saying everybody else gets a rise, but you don't ever, because we don't know what to do with you. So thank you for the delivery, but they're the challenges that I'm faced with in my Ministry of Justice and Peace. Thank you.
One at the back, yeah.
Hello, my name is Gay Brocklesby, and my interest is in, at least the area I think you wasn't mentioned, if I didn't miss it, was the difference between the societies that emphasise the individual and the group. And I think that the churches are most strongly represented, it seems to me, from their European base very often in these dialogues and things. I'm just wondering if and when the shift goes, even in Christianity, but also in other religious traditions, in the international human rights movement, to the group, to the importance of the group as a homogenous thing. For example, in the ability to become a refugee, should you ask each individual member of a family or a tribal group, do you want to return to your home, for example? Are you fleeing persecution? That the question is, should you answer each individual member, or if that society allows those decisions to be made by the leader of a clan or a group or a family, extended family? We're not used to that in this society, and I think we're very heavily emphasised in Christianity on the individual without reference to the other members of the group.
Okay, who wants to take that up?
I'll take the one on the return. Just, I suppose, to respond to the speaker there who talks about redundancies, and I mean, redundancies is definitely a very, very big feature of the modern life and the pressures. But I don't see that redundancies are necessarily difficult in the sense that we have seen a lot of organisations who are facing redundancies, and if there is a threat to the organisation, or if the company isn't going well, and if there are serious threats from abroad or from competition, and the company isn't responding to those threats, that should be known for a very long time in the company. And we have now, there are lots of different ways of dealing with that. For example, from Europe, we have in law now the Information and Consultation Directive, which means that employees are entitled to know, not just from a moral point of view, but they're absolutely entitled now by law to information on how the company is doing. So if companies don't close overnight, so if companies are experiencing serious threats and things aren't going well, that should be planned for with the workforce, and it should be planned for and taken care of over a period of time. And the better companies tend to manage this very, very well. They provide training, they provide learning opportunities, they provide career advice, and they provide all sorts of ways to protect their workers in the face of redundancies. Because the world we're living in now is about employability. It's not about employment for life. So people carry with them their skills and their talents, but they should be enabled by the company that they're working for to move towards another situation, because we are going to have redundancies, we are going to have flux, and we're going to have change, because there's this constant churn now in this society and the economy we live in. But it's the manner in which it is handled. And I would hope that because of the Information and Consultation Directive and the laws there, and also the promotion of best practice, that those kind of overnight redundancies would not be happening to the same extent in the future.
On the first question about democracy and discernment, I believe not in populist democracy. I believe in representative democracy. And so the people who are elected are not delegates, and they're not there just to reflect the biases and prejudices and ill-thought-out reflections of the general public. Ill-thought-out is important. Back to the general public. They are there as representatives. Now, this fits, in my judgment, very much with the notion of discernment. And a democratic system is at its best when representatives engage in an exercise in discernment, which can draw from many places, including the faith communities, which interposes their own judgment about the good between the ill-thought-out, unreflected points of views of their electors and the reality of change. And a system like that is to me, the best system we can come up with a large dimension of discernment, and faith communities come into it. Now, turning to the second question and the bit about asylum seekers and putting it in the context of the first. In their discernment, the new Labour administration in 1997 in the United Kingdom, in office for the first time for years, sought from Parliament a new law, the Human Rights Act. It was passed and received the Royal Assent in 1998, and in their discernment required that nobody within the country should be subjected to inhuman or degrading treatment. That was one of the provisions guaranteed in that measure. Subsequent legislation on asylum, exactly the point that's being raised, but not the precise context, scandalously withheld all opportunities for benefit and remuneration from asylum seekers as part of the government strategy of inhibiting asylum seekers from coming to the United Kingdom. However, in their discernment, using the word advisedly and repeatedly, the parliamentarians put a provision in which was that this should not offend basic human rights. So they were prepared to do something but not go so far. And this led to a remarkable case in the House of Lords, a case called Limbuella and the Secretary of State for the Home Department, where the judges, the five judges in the top court, said you cannot impoverish people in this way within this country because that is a breach of their human rights. So the human rights idea does concretize in specific situations where people are fed as a consequence of the discerning application of that in the political process. Now, the very last point from Kay about the individual and the group, I mean, this is the tension in human rights. The solution in human rights is that certain things are non-derogable, is the jargon. Certain things you cannot do. You cannot torture. You cannot reduce people to slavery. And the remaining rights, there is to some extent a balance. So one of the falsities about the presentation of the human rights argument, lapsing into the libertarian, is to suggest that you can do whatever you want. You can't. What is required is that exceptions to rights should be proportionate, which means they should be well argued and reasoned. And that seems to me a very sensible way of doing things. On community leaders who announce that they know best what the people who are silenced behind them want, and that therefore we have to pull out of a respect for the culture, my answer usually is let me talk to the individuals who are the victims, I would say, of the practice that you say we cannot question. So I'm a bit suspicious, I have to say, of community leaders who close down discussion on the basis that we cannot even enter into dialogue with the people who are affected by the practices they seek to uphold.
Yeah, I just say two points. One is about the redundancies and all that, and about a lot of the stuff that Lucy was saying. It strikes me that, you know, we look on business and commercial life in all sorts of ways. We don't look at it in the phrase that Pope John Paul used about it, that any business is a community of persons. And, I mean, that dimension is lacking. And I think maybe it's the lacking dimension is what we're actually talking about in all the things we're talking about. Archbishop Martin talked about the shock of the war. The parable of the Good Samaritan is about two people, the priest and the Levite, who are unable to be shocked. And it really, I think, the call to us from this conference is to have the ability to be shocked at what happens to refugees and what asylum seekers and so on, and we seem unable to be shocked.
Just comment on that individual community. In Catholic social teaching has actually three principles which have to be brought together and the tensions ruled out. The dignity of the individual, the unity of the human family, and the integrity of creation. And these must be brought together like concentric circles. The more we can bring them together, the more we will have a rounded approach. One other comment I will make is about mobility in the workplace and the fact that today jobs will not be for life. I would say if anybody's interested in a job for life, they're a vocations director standing outside the door.
Good plug.
Now, can we... Don't forget this side. You begin, yes, yeah? And then we...
I'm Molly Collins, and I work in Pavy Point, and I'm very interested in all the projects that I'm after here there this morning and all the discussions. But who is my neighbour? The traveller is forgotten completely, because the traveller is living... I was looking at the third world there, and it's very sad. There's a lot of travellers still living in the third world. If you, anybody that's in the audience, if they go up to the Kappa and pass the hospital and go into the right and go into the left, where there's a man in there that has to be dressed every morning with a nurse that has cancer. I do primary health care with travellers, and Ronnie Fay is our boss. And only for Ronnie Fay, our voice wouldn't be heard at all. Now, there's no... And Christopher's is in the right. With people with no electricity, no running water, 22 people shared in the one toilet, there's building going all around them, there's nobody recognised at all, the council won't even recognise them. Just during the winter there, a man had to pay €100 to the solicitor for to talk to the council. And they wanted £1,000 for the player case, but my thing is very sad. And I meant to say that in this world, in this time, in this world that's going on today, I think a traveller shouldn't be living in that appalling conditions like that.
This side, first of all, yeah.
Good afternoon, John Dolan, Disability Federation of Ireland. I'd like to thank everybody for this wonderful event, and I hope to be more like it, forums or whatever they are. Listening to Connor's paper, there was a lot of things that struck me from my own experience in the voluntary disability sector and people doing what would be described as good work and being applauded for that. But very often not asking the question or not even saying of themselves, what's their value system? Why were they doing it? We say we run these services, we run those services, but we don't emphasise too much what's behind that. Why do we do it? And so that's just one observation. But the question I'd like to put to Connor in particular is, he talked just there a minute ago about representative democracy and earlier the tension between we got the votes, that's right, and you just go with that. Twinned with representative democracy, I think we have, and the last speaker represented it in a particular way, participative democracy, or people and groups trying to participate in their state, whether it's the GAA, whether it's travellers, disabled, whatever. And is that part, or is there a possibility or a potential there to scribe another kind of thinking into civic activity? And finally, it strikes me that there's a challenge for all the faith communities to help civil society and groups, whatever area of endeavour, whether it's group water schemes, whatever it is, doesn't matter, to better articulate the value, if you like, or give them options for the value of what they're doing. Thank you very much.
There's one here.
Professor Geertje, a rudimentary point, if I may, arising from your own very stimulating talk there, in which you were very positive and even flattering concerning the affinities between the church or churches and human rights folk. I had the niggling feeling that the credibility of the church, especially our own Catholic Church, is for many people a little bit suspect in this area. There were and are very few Bartolomeo de las Casas around, I'm afraid. And this issue of origins or of foundations, which you spoke of in championing human rights and so on, did not emerge, of course, from the church quarters, but from, I think, as far as I recall, from the children of the Enlightenment. I'm thinking of Paine and the Rights of Man and so on. And I feel, therefore, that the church, you know, is perceived, at least, of arriving rather late on the scene and perhaps a little bit opportunistically even. So it's a very basic, as I say, rudimentary question or comment, so perhaps you might address it.
Yeah, thanks very much. I shall identify that as Father Tom Stack for the rest of you who didn't. He didn't receive it. Monsignor, I'm being corrected by the Archbishop. I was about to, of course, answer very vehemently, but now that I realise you're Monsignor Stack, I shall have to dilute it with a degree of respect. Thank you. Thank you, Tom, for reminding me of the need to remind ourselves that the greatest enemy of this kind of progress is a degree of complacency. And I am acutely conscious that I could have been more brutal about why it is precisely that there is this hostility to which I alluded at the start. And it would be along the lines that you described, that in fact the church has been defeated by the Enlightenment, that its desire for control has been seen off, and that it has embarked upon the Human Rights Project as a kind of consolation for the lack of power that it would desire. That would be the brutal framework which would be presented by some. And I think we need to confront that. In a brilliant book, Bruno Forte, who's a superb man, The Essence of Christianity, he peppers his analysis of the present with its bleak prognosis, with constant refrain, we would never turn back to the pre-modern period. We would never reject the Enlightenment. Now, I heard my host say much the same in an immediate response to my remarks along the lines of there being fundamentalists on two sides. And I think that, well, I wouldn't be here if I were not convinced that that credibility issue was being directly addressed at the moment. And the church, I believe, is confronting that point. It's critical that the advances, no dispute about the word, of the Enlightenment period are accepted. Because if they aren't accepted, then I'm not here. And there's an awful lot of people like me who wouldn't be here. But that's just, thank you for giving me the chance to say it specifically. And now it's a related point. I think what we heard about the travellers is very important. I'll just deal with the ones that dealt with me since this has come up. There is a real challenge from what we heard here from Bishop Don about shock. How do you preserve shock? You know, it used to be called compassion fatigue. Now there is and John's remark about the voluntary sector. I did a talk to the Heathrop group in London a couple of years back where I said that actually the human rights thing is the children of people who used to believe. And what they've done is they've grown up in believing households, but they're not themselves believers. But they have a residual cultural commitment to what they grew up with. And it doesn't, and this is the rub, get translated onto the next generation. So my rather pessimistic, for the Jesuits, point was that human rights and doing good in a civil society is a society in transition out of a religious commitment into a sort of selfish secular society. And that this is a generational thing and it'll fade away. Now, Taylor's book, A Secular Age, is not entirely dissimilar in his concerns about how you build a civil society committed to giving in a world which has rejected faith or is on the way to rejecting faith. So those people on the analysis, the voluntary disability sector, why are they involved? You know, on this analysis, they grew up in a culture which was used to the church. They're not passing it on to their children. They're passing on kind of do-gooding to the children without the kind of ammunition of faith, and that the children won't necessarily follow it up. I think that is a very real concern. And that's why I'm doing a lot of trying to underpin human rights in a way that appeals across the sectors in order to fortify new generations of people with alternative reasons for sustaining this commitment. Now, on civil society, participative democracy, absolutely central to this. My representative democracy model was not intended to to make civil society less important, more important. Because what civil society does is it frames common sense. You know, it makes effective political leaderships think it obvious to embrace ideas which civil society has made common sense. So civil society is an important counterpoint to capital and an important counterpoint to selfishness because it opens up space for political leaders to risk change in the direction of civil society. So it's in an ideal society, there's a connection between representative government, cautious leaders who seek to, with discernment, push the culture in the direction they desire the culture to go, and civil society that supports them. One of the most depressing things in American England has been the way in which the right wing have understood that, and the left wing never have. The right wing have pushed the agenda of extremism. The left wing have not. And we need to return to this notion of a civil society which creates space for good liberal activism in the political process.
Just on the two points there, well, on the participative democracy, I think I might just reflect that in Ireland we do have quite a lot of, representation from civil society and civil groups in the partnership process. I mean, as you know, in the last 10 years, the community and voluntary sector are very well represented in that partnership process. Now, it's always difficult to get their real concerns at the top of the agenda in the face of all of the big pay discussions and the cut and thrust of those partnership discussions. But they are very central in the process, and they are participants in the National Economic and Social Council. So there's quite a good model there to develop. Now, it has to develop further, but there's the start of a process there, I think, that really does cater for a much broader range of groups in society, and indeed the travellers as well. But I also say, in relation to the travellers, indeed, our findings would say that travellers do suffer an awful lot of discrimination in relation to work and access to workplaces. And in order to deal with that, we have done a lot of work with the Equality Authority. The Equality Authority here is quite a powerful force in terms of building equality into our society and our workplaces, and they have been quite successful at that. The difficulty is that they to date, they have worked on the basis of taking cases in law, and that is only, I suppose, it has only a certain amount of effectiveness, because really the structures and the legalistic approach is only part of the solving of the problem, because it doesn't fully counter prejudice and discrimination. So some of the work that we have done with the Equality Authority is looking at a broader approach to this, and looking at the positive aspects of more inclusive workplaces and the benefits and the business case for diversity. And as recently as June, we published an international piece and the international evidence for a greater levels of openness and diversity in our workplaces because of the need to include all groups, but also to get different wisdoms and different points of view from different sectors in society, because they are, I suppose, in work terms, they're the customers as well as the members of our society to which we're providing a service. But I do fully appreciate and empathise with that your lady's contribution there about travellers, and I do sympathise with your position, and it is one that we're very aware of.
I just say, I think, again, this is part of a bigger question, to enabling civil society and people in society to value what they're doing. I think that involves seeing it as part of a bigger picture. And I think it applies particularly, I think, to the church. I mean, the thing that disheartens me sometimes, people say, you know, I've got several young children, I'm too involved in bringing up those children to have any time to take part in the life of the parish. Now, what do they think a Christian community is? And I think that we need to expand people's view of the significance of what they do in their daily lives, and you know that it has a much bigger significance than just the here and now. It's part of a much bigger picture.
I think that's the last questions we can take before lunch. I just myself say, with regard to the travelling community, we launched a book on the health of travellers in the Dublin area, and it is really an extraordinary thing that people in our members of our society should find themselves being disadvantaged on such a fundamental right as the right to life, the life expectancy being, and that's just one indication. About participation, one of the things that we should be looking at and talking about participatory democracy is, what is today the role of political parties? They are the fundamental instrument of mediation between citizen and the political world. And I really believe in many parts of Europe and the world, they have lost their track. also due to the cost of politics. Just look, for example, the cost of being elected President of the United States. It's ludicrous. And many of the political parties have become dinosaurs that eat up funds. With regard to international civil society, I'd like to give one example of how powerful international civil society can be. In 1995, there was a conference held in Copenhagen on the World Summit on Social Development, from which the Millennium Development Goals actually emerged. I led the Vatican delegation at that, and I had clear instructions to add in a reference to landmines. And I got a choral no, particularly from the European Union, but from many others, because they said this is a conference about social development and not about disarmament. If you go through the document of that conference, you'll find two references to certain conventional weapons which can be particularly injurious and have indiscriminate effects. That is the title of a UN convention which had been ratified by most governments, and they couldn't refuse that. But most people in their right senses could never identify that as the reference to landmines. That was 1995. 2 years later, there was a choral yes in Ottawa to a convention banning the use of landmines. Now, what happened in those 2 years? Was it that people were converted by my preaching? No. It was that international civil society garnished around itself a consensus, and to put it very bluntly, I think for the first time in the history, they rented governments to call the international conference, but the initiative came from them. We have another case coming up on cluster bombs, which the Irish government will be hosting in a few months' time. Again, the fruit of a combination between highly motivated civil society and open governments to that. One final comment before we go for lunch. We will be back here at 2:15. Is that right? 2:15? You were talking about different modalities for recognising people in the workplace. One that you didn't mention was non-monetary remuneration or non-monetary respect. There, I believe the Catholic Church has a great contribution to make, because we have got canons, we have monsignors, we've got all sorts of titles which actually mean nothing but which make people happy. Nuns.